Hello.
Hello.
Hi.
Are you waiting for the course to come on?
I am.
Yeah.
My name is Kathy Hart.
Hi, Kathy. Where are you? My name's Brad Swanson.
I'm in Florida.
Yeah. Have you been?
Where are you?
I'm up on the other end of the East Coast. I'm up in Maine.
Oh, you're cold, huh?
Yeah, it's gotten more fall-like. We've had some pretty nice days, but they're unusual. So, yeah, it's fall, getting to be that time of year.
Snow
tomorrow, Wednesday, yeah.
It's beautiful. It's beautiful up there.
I love living up here, yeah. You've been up here then.
I was born in Connecticut. And so I still have family there. So I've gone there for many, many, many years, and it's a beautiful part of the country. It's just too cold for me now.
A lot of people say that. It doesn't get any warmer.
But for visiting, it's lovely.
Yeah, come up in the summer and fall and spend some time. It's awfully nice, as you know.
Yeah, absolutely. Down here, it's a little too hot in the summer, but at this time of year is the reason why I moved to Florida, because the weather is nice, but the summers are brutal.
What part of Florida are you in?
I'm in South Florida. I live in Dania Beach.
Have you experienced the ravages of these last two hurricanes? I guess Nicole was East Coast, but...
We got spared, but, I mean, I have people over in Fort Myers, you know, and it's just awful. But the East Coast got spared, even the last one that just passed through. We got a bunch of rain and wind, you know, but nothing to complain about.
Well, now, don't let me interrupt. Good gossip. I just arrived a little bit early, but I hope you guys are doing great. Any thoughts or questions or follow-up from our first seminar after it's kind of marinated for a while? Anybody want to add or ask anything? I really appreciate the responses that you've sent, the responses to the questions, and the kind words, and you're really bringing it alive, and I promise I'll work in responses to what I was planning to say anyhow. But any thoughts or questions right now? Any takeaways from the first seminar that were meaningful to you or that you didn't expect? One at a time. Go ahead.
Oh, I thought the whole seminar was excellent. You know,
would you do your first name?
Kathy Hart.
Okay, super. Great.
Hey, I thought the whole thing was great. I mean, listen, anything you have to tell me is great. And I just enjoy.
Okay.
I just enjoy your instruction. I really do.
Well, super. Thank you very much. And I really appreciate the responses to the questions. They help orient me to what would be most useful. Go ahead. There was somebody else who was going to add.
I'm not sure how many of us are here, but this is Brad from Maine. Hi, Dave.
Yeah, welcome. Hey.
I'm very curious about the neuroscience and how what we know about the brain allows us to work meaningful, but more productive ways with our clients.
Yeah.
I think we can be very well-intended sometimes, but knowing how memories are made and how new behaviors can be brought on board and become the dominant behavior versus... Now, I consider myself kind of a cognitive behavior. I think
okay.
The way you think is the way you act, and the way you act is the way you behave. And understanding the neuroscience of that is just pretty interesting. So I'm an avid learner, and I'm just really absorbing more of the information that that you have that sort of builds on what I've already started to understand. So thank you.
Okay, thank you, and I think that's really important. As I mentioned in the beginning, there's so many ways that we try to facilitate change that are contrary to the way the mind and brain work, but I think especially for us as mentor coaches, how we begin to think about engaging a client, how we approach a conversation, can be meaningful because that boots up a particular mindset that as we talked at the beginning of last time, if you give instruction, information, tell somebody what to do, it's going to result in a particular kind of response. If you ask an open-ended question, it's going to engage someone to respond because there's nothing to react to, or there's nothing to agree or confirm or refute because you have an engagement. And that's the framework of what we do and how we proceed is one of collaboration. Then really understanding more about the mind and brain and looked at from a different perspective. There, if you think about all the different schools of therapy that there are. And what we do is so distinctly different. It's not a thin gray line, but a broad black line and a whole other body of knowledge. But just for a moment, there are many methods and schools of therapy, but there is one common element about any and each of the therapies, if they work, that determine why they work. What do you think that is?
Well, I guess it's kind of a neurophysiological change. Something happens
exactly.
In the brain to overwrite old patterns and create new ones.
Yeah, it's the neural association. You change what you associate something to. We're going to be talking about that. And the way that they work and why what's common to all is exactly what we're going to be talking about and doing that even more directly. So how we engage with someone to be able to collaboratively do that is, I think, an important aspect. So, again, we're just beginning. And go ahead.
No, I was saying thank you. I like the direction that the course is going. To build on, you know, what my small understanding is. So much about neurology that we can't, and maybe brain science that we can't really grasp, but how it works is you're educating us on a level that I'm
okay.
You know,
great. Let me thank you. I appreciate that. Let me remind each of you if you're not about to talk, would you mute *6 because your microphone will pick up coughs and clearing of your throat that you won't hear, but we will. So, and remember to unmute when you come back to talk. So, we talked about, and just to extend that a little bit, Brad's comment, we talked about how mental framing can determine outcome, in a beginning way last time. Now, here's a simple way. What do you think of when I say, don't think of an elephant? Now, that's, and just think about it for a second. That statement, it's also the title of a book by Dr. George Lakoff, ensures you will think of an elephant. Whatever the focus, whether it's negative or positive, it activates the imagery of an elephant. Neuroscience and quantum physics show us that we get what we focus on, not what we want. And the focus can be determined in a number of ways to enhance effectiveness and performance. And what activates a particular brain mindset, how we determine that, is something that will be important, I think, as you're working with clients. And I want to respond to some of the specific questions that have been sent in relation to that. But just as a sidebar here, make a note if you're interested and have the time for our last seminar 4, I'd like to extend that to have just a discussion and question and answer of anything you think about that we didn't cover. So at the just after or from the top of the hour on for another, 15 or 20 minutes, we can just have a discussion to look at anything that you want to talk about a little bit more or that we didn't cover. So I'm going to, in just a minute or two, put us on lecture mode and get into the material so we'll have some time in the end to discuss. But any other thoughts or questions at this point?
Yeah, okay. Dave, this is Brad
yes.
again.
I'm sorry, yeah, go ahead.
Yeah, from Maine. The idea of embodied memory. Does your model incorporate that sort of the ideology or the ideas that the whole mind body the whole mind body coaching approach where a lot of our memory is in fact stored physically?
We'll talk about that because I think there's some concepts and an application, some of which do and some of which don't
okay.
get supported by neuroscience. So we'll talk about that. And remember, in the very beginning, I just touched on this to say, and we apply it in a little bit of a different way. Every algorithm that determines thought, feeling, behavior, experience, even body memory, if it's important, it will get activated in the process of the work with you as a coach. So we never have to go into the past. We never have to dig deep or go into dynamics or origins or problems or issues. Anything and everything that's important will manifest in the process with you as a coach. The client is always going to show you exactly what it's like to be him or her. So we know that feelings don't reside in the heart, but that's a metaphor. That various kind of gut feelings we may experience it in that way, but that's a form of an intuitive process that's really a mind-brain process, even though it's experienced in various ways. So we'll return to that and ask again if you don't think we've adequately explored it. And that's a good point because we're looking at various applications of how we think, feel, and experience and the various patterns that we have, attachment patterns, emotional, behavioral, other kinds of patterns have all become hardwired. And that's why I say everything that's important will be manifest in the work with you, so we have to be comfortable really listening to and looking at the process, not just the content. I'll give you some examples of that as we'll go along, and I hear from the questions some of you have asked that it will be helpful to apply this. So I'm going to begin just a minute or two into our discussion tonight to talk about a case and give you an illustration of some things I'm talking about. So I'm going to put us on lecture mode so you don't have to worry about breathing from this point on and reserve a few minutes at the end for discussion. Okay, we're going to talk about mastery of mind states and mentalization. I want to discuss in this session what I think is the most important variable to determine success for an individual, the mastery of regulating states of mind. And this is some of what we do as coaches to help someone self-reflect, become aware, become empathic with themselves, and then look at regulating states of mind. So first of all, what is a state of mind? A state of mind is a mind-body state, like a specific software program that determines how we perceive and process information and how we respond. So that says, to Brad's question, there is no mind or brain or body response. it is all a psychophysiological experience that is all integrated. So a state of mind is a set of particular emotions, memories, mental models, behavior patterns. It's like a software program, and we have many different states of mind. A key element in our work is helping a client become aware, perhaps, of various states of mind with a particular focus on what state works best for what purpose. In other words, somebody is upset and become anxious. They have responded to some emotional trigger to boot up a state that is framed by anxiety. So that's going to determine how they perceive and process what follows. The regulation of that to get grounded and centered means that they've moved back to a search engine for all those states of mind rather than getting locked into or stuck in a particular state of mind. So an illustration of the simplest illustration I know of how states of mind are like different software packages. You probably were exposed to this maybe back in college. If you take a rat, put it in a maze, you can teach it how to get to the cheese, and it can go again and again. Now, if you inject the rat with just a little bit of amphetamine before you teach it, you can still teach it. It can go again and again. But if you take away the amphetamine, the rat can't get to the cheese. It can, in that maze, literally die of starvation, even though it has in a part of its brain how to get to the cheese. Reinject the amphetamine, it immediately goes to the cheese. State-dependent learning, state-specific memory. This is an example of two distinct states of mind without overlap. And that's not usual. That may be more like post-traumatic stress disorder or multiple personality disorder. Now, a more common example is when you try to think of somebody's name and you can't, it's on the tip of your tongue, you just can't quite recall it. Then later, in a more relaxed state, you just ordered your salad at dinner and boom, the name is there. So it's a different state of mind. A state of mind is a mind-body state, again, like a specific software program that determines how we perceive and process information and how we respond. Each of us has a range of states, maybe with some awareness of what state works best for what endeavor, how to enter and exit different states. I'll come back to that in just a bit. It's important to become aware of which state to enter, say, for a creative endeavor like writing, versus a state to enter for planning or editing. Two different parts of the brain, two different functions, not to go back and forth. So here's an example. I'm going to discuss what I derive from this, but I'm going to begin with the case so that you'll hear where I was at the beginning of what I later evolved as a kind of microsystem of regulating states of mind. A client I'll call Barbara paused during one of our mentor coaching sessions, focusing on her executive leadership, and she was doing great and had soared, to mention almost parenthetically that she was going to be distracted over the Thanksgiving holidays. And this was not recent. This was back in the day. And looked forward to getting back and resuming her new project at her company. And I heard her momentary discomfort and asked about her expectations of the holidays. She mentioned that she would like to spend some time working on it, that she was aware of a pattern in that every time she goes home, and she would pick one major holiday for the year, this particular year it was Thanksgiving, and she noticed the same issues. And she described it with some reluctance and embarrassment, but basically this was it. We have a big family gathering. My parents, brother, sister, their families all come together for a holiday weekend, usually 3 days. I resolve before I leave that this time will be different. I will not get into arguments or struggles with my parents and brother and sister. This is a very sophisticated and accomplished woman. I focus intensely on being balanced and not resorting to the squabbles and upset. I usually last most of the first day, and then something happens and I lose it. And I heard her discomfort, her effort to address it. I get in a fight with one of my family, and it seems to escalate. Then I'm in a fight with all of them. We're at a standoff for the rest of the holiday time. This doesn't happen except when I'm there with them. I cannot maintain my cool, but I can at all other times. In person, I just lose it. Is there anything you can do to help me with this? Well, I first reflected how frustrating this must be for her to want to enjoy a holiday with her family and have things work out be different, and how committed she was to do that. She readily agreed. I said, at the time you're in the middle of that upset, in those arguments with them, what's the age of that conversation? She immediately knew what I was talking about. She didn't need no explanation. She said, early adolescence. I'm 13, instantly, and totally at that time. And I'm stuck there for the rest of the visit. And it's just like it was then. She wanted a close, meaningful relationship with her parents and siblings, and understandably wanted to share her personal and professional successes and her experiences and hear the same from her siblings, adult to adult. But in a state triggered by emotion, she only wanted to be right, to be heard, to express it. She was 13 all over again, and she couldn't get out of it. And again, this is a very sophisticated woman, and she was appalled at herself for this. I asked her specifically what she was aware of that triggered her reactions. She described, and I asked her for detail, the specific detail, and she got more detail as she... A particular look from her dad, a word from her mother, a gesture from her brother that would be exactly what she experienced at 13, that would instantly create that state change of her adolescence. And it was a whole adolescent period of time, not just a particular age, but and her reactive mood of that turmoil. For example, when her dad rolled his eyes, she was instantly transported to that time capsule of anger and resentment and feeling controlled and criticized by him, not being good enough, expecting negative judgment. We talked about things that had worked and things that had worked for a time, and we finally got to this aspect. I suggested that she schedule a time to do a brainstorming with herself, at least maybe 30 minutes, with no interruptions, no distractions, to reflect on the new plan that she had begun. I suggested, as she had already done in the beginning way, that she write a list of each of the emotional triggers that she was aware of with each member of her family. I asked her to get a single sheet of paper and draw three vertical lines, and in column one, to put emotional triggers and write down every emotional trigger that she was aware of. And I suggested for column two that she put down her usual response, thought, feeling, behavior. So column two would include all of the reactive behaviors and feelings that she had to each of the specific triggers. Now, I suggested she do this in a way to be an observer, to not get triggered by remembering the incident or seeing what she saw that triggered her, but to remain an observer, because this was an important part, to develop that observing capacity and self-reflective capacity so that she could be empathic with her earlier experiences, ultimately, or her earlier self, without getting there. So it wasn't going to be triggering to trip and fall in that time capsule. I suggest she schedule another brainstorming session with herself, an actual schedule of a period of time, maybe a couple of days later, at least a day later, that she think about, for column three, a mantra. Now, explain the mantra is three parts, a cue, a focus, and a physiology. And I gave her the example that when the new coach came to University of Southern Utah, he inherited a team that was dead last in free shot percentage, 217 out of 217 in their division. He immediately instituted a way of practicing free throws, a cue, a focus, a physiology. What he emphasized was to do a cue as soon as he stepped to the line to dribble the basketball twice, and at the same time to have a focus phrase like relaxed and powerful, because focus aligns the energy field of the brain, and physiology, a deep breath in, to breathe in relaxation and breathe out any tension. And those are the two most powerful ways to regulate and change a state of mind, focus and physiology. Now, he had them do that each time they practiced, and if they made it, if they made the shot, they got a breather. If they didn't make it, they took four laps. And during practice, to simulate a game, because in a game you don't get to go to the line and shoot 30 free throws and get to count your best, he would blow the whistle, he'd go to the line and do their shot. In doing it in this way, in 2 years they were the number one team in their division nationwide, because the cue, the focus, the physiology got each of them in 3 to 5 seconds grounded and centered to enter the flow, that performance flow of practice and performance in the same mindset, so that they could do it without thinking about it. So I suggested this for her then, to think about a mantra, and it may be the same mantra for every cue, but then for each emotional trigger, to write in column 4, what's your ideal response? How would you ideally like to think and feel and behave in relation to that particular trigger? Notice how we're talking about neuroassociative conditioning, changing the association. The one thing in all the therapies and in coaching that can create change. So we're making a system of it and creating a system for her to do that, so that she would be more aware of the emotional triggers and be able to recognize it sooner and sooner to be able then to choose to get grounded and centered and enter that ideal state. Now, after that's done enough times, you go all the way across horizontally, each trigger, getting grounded and centered, ideal response or behavior, that will rewire the brain. Now, but it takes time. So I emphasize to her, this is not going to be automatic, but this is to help you regulate your state of mind and to stay in that optimum state. What you may need to do in the beginning is you may need to do your cue, and she had a short phrase that she decided to use. You may need to say that several times. You may even remember, this is not the NBA. You don't have only 5 timeouts in your Thanksgiving holiday. You can excuse yourself at any point if you feel that you need a bit more time, especially in the beginning, until this becomes more familiar. Well, in our first session, after the Thanksgiving holiday, I was really eager to hear how it went. She immediately began the session by saying it was the best holiday she'd ever had. There were times of challenge. There were even times she would excuse herself for a private walk or just going to the next room to get grounded and centered, or sometimes going to the bathroom and splashing some water in her face. She was immensely pleased with her work, as I was for her. She came to realize that the previous emotional triggers, like the first thing, the phrase from her mom, really now, or the eye roll from her dad, could be reframed as recognition of their humanness of her adulthood to respond in a different way. This new attachment pattern allowed her to relate to them in an adult way that was different for each of them and her. And after significant repetition, she rewired a new default pattern to create a different response to each cue rather than having it result in the familiar state change. So she noted about her Thanksgiving script. That was incredible, but it was really hard work. And I said, I understand how hard and how successfully you worked. The only thing harder, as you already know, is not doing it. So she was able to use this, and in later holidays, she has done very, very well with this and has totally moved to a different way of relating to her family. So let's talk a little bit more about accessing states of mind. How we regulate feelings and states of mind, it's important to understand and master how we access a particular state rather than just letting it happen. You know, think about, here's some examples. Probably nowhere is this more poignant than with artists and writers who enter a creative state. Dame Edith Sitwell would lie in the stale solitude of an open coffin as a prelude to enter the genre of mind to write her macabre literature. Voltaire used his lover's back for a writing desk. Benjamin Franklin and one of my favorite nonfiction writers, Diane Ackerman, wrote on a pine plank while they were soaking in a bathtub to get that kind of floaty creative feeling. The painter Turner liked to be lashed to the mast of a ship and taken for sail during an incredible storm and then come back and immediately go to the canvas and recreate his experience. Some authors play a piece of music repetitively during the course of writing to create an emotional framework to house their evolving story. So this is an example or examples of ways of being aware of what state of mind works best for what purpose. So when you are ready to perhaps give a presentation, you may want to be relaxed and powerful and do a brief mantra. Mine is simply putting together the index finger, my index finger and thumb of both hands and touching them like an infinity before like a keynote. Now, that's not what's going to be most effective to get to sleep at night. You don't want to be powerful when you want to have the mantra. You want to have the focus phrase match the purpose. So you may want to be relaxed to sleep, and you may want to focus. Well, we'll come back to other ways to do this. So this is something that has application because the thing that each of you will experience, and I'll bet it will be with every client, is as you think about it, to help them regulate their state of mind. If they began with, you know, something that was very upsetting, you want to resonate with that experience, as we talked last time, but then you want to help them understand how to regulate a state of mind. So this is something that, this is simply one way to do it, and how you do it and how you engage someone of doing it and what's worked for them and evolving to their own system. These are simply some fundamentals of a way to think about it. Think about some applications here and the subtleties of framing an experience. Credit cards. Decouple buying, the activation of the pleasure center, and paying, the activation of the pain center in the brain. The pleasure of the purpose is segmented from the pain of future payment. And this segmentation renders repayment a future abstraction. So what happens? people buy 23% more when they pay for it with a credit card than when they do with actual cash or check, because it's not so abstract in that way. It's now. It's real. There's we'll come back to pain and pleasure as one of the underlying aspects. So let's look at how do you regulate states of mind. The most important thing we can do to achieve success is to manage our emotions and regulate our states of mind. A couple of recent studies, I've touched on this, so I want to reiterate, in Scientific American Mind and Harvard Business Review found that the most common an important factor in the success of executives was the ability to self-regulate and manage their emotions. Of all the training, degrees, business certificate, all of that, and I think that is applicable because that's all they studied is executives. I think it's the same for everyone. To regulate states of mind, manage emotions, and optimally select the state of mind to do whatever engagement or performance. So, what do these people have in common? John Belushi, Marilyn Monroe, Elvis Presley, Janis Joplin, F. Scott Fitzgerald, Kurt Cobain. They never learned the critical success strategy of managing their states of mind using drugs, alcohol, or some other addictive substance or process to regulate a state of mind and manage emotions can lead to significant compromise. Your state of mind, the particular software or program you use, determines the meaning you attach to a stimulus. The meaning you attach then determines your behavior. That's the neuroassociation. So, as I mentioned, the two primary ways to regulate a state of mind is focus and physiology. And this is in part how we frame things. How we frame it determines the state of mind that we boot up to deal with it. So how do we get to this with our clients? We ask questions. We don't tell anybody, give them directions. Data, it doesn't work. We ask questions because that engages someone because there's nothing to oppose, nothing to agree with. People thought Goliath was too big to hit. David asked, well, if he's that big, how could I miss? Starbucks founder Howard Schultz didn't ask people if they wanted to buy a cup of coffee or tell them to buy a cup of coffee or a latte, but do you want a concept of community, a third place between home and work? Now, listen to how Steve Jobs convinced former Pepsi president at the time, John Sculley, to become CEO at Apple. They were on a balcony overlooking Central Park in New York City, and Jobs simply asked Sculley, you want to sell sugared water all your life, or do you want to change the world? So he captured, in a question, purpose. So here's an exercise that I'd suggest that you do. Just before you go to bed, or sometime during the day, but have the questions written down at your bedside table so they're the first thing you see when you turn on the lamp. Write down three questions that will put you in a peak state. Each morning, answer these three empowering questions and feel the answer. Now, remember, you're already asking yourself questions, probably even before you're fully awake. This just changes the focus to consciously engineer those questions that empower you. Let me give you an example of this. I was asked to, a buddy of mine who's a chair at Vistage, asked me to do a workshop with her CEOs and business owners. There were probably about 20 people there, and they had been going through, as a group, a really trying time because two of the people, one a business owner and one a CEO, had had incidents at their businesses and that were extremely charged, and one of them had resulted in some death. So they had been preoccupied with this, were not able to get beyond the trauma and the stress, and it was infectious with the group. And she said, "Man, Dave, I don't know what to do. Can you come in and do a stress workshop or something?" I said, "Sure, I would look forward to it." So here's the essence boiled down. You get the cheap seat and the bottom line. I ask them each to do this exercise. Well, first, let me preface it. I ask the people who were willing to talk about it, what was the first thing they thought about? And the first thing many of them said, what's going to go wrong today? Or am I going to have something at my company like she had or like he had? So I asked them to, let's think about engineering this and focus it in an informed way. Write those three questions that are empowering, put you in a positive state of mind, because that's going to frame how your feet hit the carpet, how you get up each morning, and it's going to frame the first part of your day. So write down three questions that are empowering, put you in a very positive state of mind. I got feedback from my buddy who runs a group a week later that these questions had turned things around, especially at those two companies and for the organization, because the leader's infectious mood and state of mind was concerning for many people in leadership, and it trickled down. So that did a turnaround because it simply engineered the framework of how you began the day, because the framework determines what you perceive, how you process it, and how you behave. So this is another example of what we talked about with the free throw shooting, Southern Utah University's Roger Reed, and going to number one. So we're talking about neural conditioning. What we associate to a stimulus is what determines our behavior. So to change your behavior, change your neural association. And this is a systematic, a little micro system, a little systematic way of doing it. And there are others, and we'll talk about some others. But so thinking positively, though, is not enough. You can think positively for a moment, but then you go back to what's already been established in your brain because it's hardwired. It's the neural networks and connections. So you have to have a systematic way to create new connections, to disrupt that, to create learning and unlearning. And what we're specialists in as coaches is breaking the script, doing something different, tolerating with our help and our empathic resonance the difficulty it is interpreting the challenge, the discomfort of doing something new, not as meaning that you're doing the wrong thing or your gut's telling you that this is not right, but it's expected because that's exactly how our brain works. Remember we talked about the how we get feedback from our brain about what it expects. And if it's not what we expect, then there's discomfort. Every time we take a step into a new direction, it's going to be with discomfort. We need to understand this with our clients to resonate with their discomfort. We're not going to give them a little lecture about the error detection mechanism, but, you know, I understand, and you can expect to feel discomfort when you try something new because it's the default mode to do the same thing, even when it's not working. That's probably more than, you know, say always say less than necessary. Robert Greene's one of the 48 rules of power. So this is important that you understand inside your head the meaning that you give, because that determines your behavior. So a neural association gets linked or anchored by the coupling at times just a strong emotion to whatever is happening around you. This creates a link. Anchors happen when you're in a highly motivated state. So That's exactly what we want to help someone do, is to create a cue, a focus phrase, some kind of anchor to instantly move into that state of optimum performance. Now, let's deconstruct this for just a bit. There are two major forces behind all behavior. The desire to gain pleasure and the need to avoid pain. One moves toward to gain, the other moves away to prevent pain, to protect. To understand the motivating forces of pain and pleasure, the need to avoid pain is biological. It's helped us survive. The brain fights against change to avoid pain on a biological basis. So trying to create success by creating more pain, unless achieving that success, doesn't work nearly as well. So to gain or prevent pain moves us in every personal and business decision. Examples of gain: promotion, make more money, improve our health, get what we desire. Examples of preventing pain: to avoid change, to buy insurance, to save money, to stay away from something we're afraid of. Spending money in this moment is a greater pleasure than the idea of a later gain or the abstraction of savings or future need or retirement. So guess what happens? People don't really save nearly enough. Now, what can reverse this? Emily Pronin at Princeton did a very simple study that's been replicated and extrapolated. People who can picture their future selves, what they're going to look like at 70 or 80, save between 2 and 3 times as much as someone who can't do that. So they're, guess what? They're in computer-enhanced imageries to show someone what they're going to look like. What, for example, if they exercise 5 times a week, this is what they're going to look like at 75. If they keep smoking, here's what they're going to look like. If they gain a pound a year, here's what they look like. So to change your behavior, you have to change what you link to pleasure and what you link to pain. The need to avoid pain is usually greater than the need for pleasure. This drives much of human behavior. So to influence someone, find out what they're already influenced by, what they link pain and pleasure to. If you're not doing something that you want or need to do, you link more pain with doing it than not doing it. If you don't have enough money or money that you want, somewhere in your unconscious mind, you link greater pain, maybe not be so unconscious, you link greater pain to having it. So this is what we listen for in one way of thinking about it as coaches. What's the surface story? What is somebody telling themselves and you about what they want? You know, I want to generate more income and create wealth. Well, we listen. That's 5 to 10% of the operating system. We're listening in case there's a shadow story that may go in the opposite direction and create the suck. Well, you know, all this effort it would take, I think I'm just as comfortable where I am. Or, you know, people would judge me. I'll be ostracized. I'll be lonely. I don't think I have what it really takes. I don't know if I want to spend that much time away from my family and friends. So if you're sabotaging success in any area of your life, look at the approach, wanting pleasure, and avoidance, having fear. And a usual focus is, what's going to be the pain if I do this? The need for focus, what's the pain if you don't do it? What will be the cost and pain if you don't do it? So these are coaching questions once we find someone's goal. And we hear procrastination or some other way of avoiding. What's the greater pleasure if you do this? What's the greater pain if you don't? And remember, the reason that we do something is how we imagine we're going to feel when we do it. That's what motivates us. So why not make that into a question, too? How do you imagine you'll feel when you do it? So we're defined by the stories we tell ourselves, by our scripts, some of which are not so conscious, which is where you're going to earn your money with your clients, because this is what you're able to listen for, the process of what's there that they're not aware of. The unconscious biases, the inattention blindness, the things that they automatically associate without even being aware of the active dynamic process because it's been hardwired. Is your story empowering you or causing you to fall short? Is your story a limiting story in any area of your life? Which one is true? The one you pick will be the one you believe and live. Most people are stuck because of the story they tell themselves, the one that came from 10 years ago, or the one they want to believe. Your story contains the patterns that shape your behavior. Think about it this way. What's the biggest addiction we have? The thing almost impossible to give up or abstain from? The pattern sequence that gives us an effective focus and actually allows us to escape our own fear as well as charging and energizing us. Our biggest addiction is problems. Now, because that's already hardwired. You know where you're going. You can be, think about, you're on the patio, you're having a glass of Chardonnay with your buddy. How soon is it going to take for one of the two of you, before you listen to this particular seminar, to get animated by a problem or an issue or a challenge or the waiter that caused you to choose to walk out when you were just served that plate of oysters Rockefeller? How soon will it be? Because we're hardwired for this. For any situation, there are three components: state, story, and strategy. State management is the most important aspect to choose the mindset that matches a successful outcome. State always comes first. A simple example of that, your client calls you and says, you know, well, I just had a really upsetting incident, but I know I need to focus on. Your response is to resonate with that state. Remember we did the circle and the stick figure? You empathically resonate with that state, not to validate it, not to linger, but just say, you know, I hear how upsetting that was. And then, ultimately, what would be most useful for us to focus on for this session? Story is the organizer of what you do, the theme and storyline to what you're pursuing. For Martin Luther King, his story was, I have a dream. Now, remember, your client does not hear it, does not see it, or think of it as a story. This is our organizer. For the client, it's not a story. It's just the way things are. That's their life. So that's important to really remember and to think about in that way, that this is our organizer. So as we do that, remember that this is how we're conceptualizing, because I'm not going to be talking to my clients like I'm talking to you guys, okay? Now, so how do you condition yourself to make changes that last? There are three simple steps. Identify what to change. And some questions for this. If you don't change your pattern, what will be the consequences? What's the pain associated to this choice that you make? What would be the pleasure with changing? And secondly, to interrupt the existing pattern, to break the script. Some questions. What are the cues or triggers for this automatic pattern? How can you interrupt the pattern once you've identified it? Using this system, the neuroassociative conditioning, that we just, the chart you just drew, the four-part chart. Now, this is also, if you go to homepage of MentorPath, my website, M-E-N-T-O-R-P-A-T-H, at the very bottom of the first page, there's a link for a 30-minute webinar on Master States of Mind, and there's more explanation of this neuroassociative chart, this neuroconditioning chart that you'll see there. What are the cues or triggers? Think of ways to interrupt the pattern once you've identified. And three, create a new association that empowers you to look at things you gain, the pleasure that you'll create from the change. You're changing what you associate to a trigger. It's exactly what we addressed in that chart, the four columns that I elaborated with what I call her, Barbara. So here's some questions for this step. What's the new association to this usual trigger? What's the change you want to bring about? What's the ideal behavior? And then think about the things you gain and the pleasure you'll have with that change. So these kinds of things are about self-reflection and self-regulation. This is something that is simply a systematic way to go about regulating states of mind and managing emotions. Remember, we talked at the very beginning, if you want to change, don't focus on the goal only. Everybody has the same goal. Winners and losers have the same goal. Focus on the system, because this is what you'll need to do to help someone create change. One more simple example, and then I'll stop for us to talk about any questions. Here's another case example from a different perspective. I'll call him Nathan. Nathan was a well-known nonfiction writer just off a New York Times bestseller, but he was experiencing writer's block. He'd not produced anything for like 4 months when he called me. So what we looked at was his writing process, to walk me through it step by step in detail. I wanted to see frame by frame what was going on in his head, to describe what he did, what he was experiencing. And then I asked him to talk about, to give words to his internal dialogue. I wanted to hear what he was saying to him, what his self-talk was. He described how, as he sat down to write, I realized I get nervous, and I began doing a lot of different things other than writing. So he was saying, I lost or gave up my focus. Then I start wondering if I can produce another bestseller, or if that bestseller was just a one-time thing. So we looked at the details of his process and his distractions, and he recognized he needed to create a system and to stay with the system and the focus. That allowed me to look then at another level of this, and about how he framed it, what he was experiencing in this, I get nervous and begin doing a lot of different things. So I could observe, after hearing some details, it sounds like you get really excited, maybe more so than ever, about immersing yourself in the passion you've always wanted to experience. He said, you know, that's exactly right. When I read it as anxiety, it's like all the old stuff comes back. And I said, that's very understandable. You know, in your old story, anxiety meant danger, and you're instantly in that story when you experience it as anxiety. And he said, yeah, distancing myself, distracting myself like I do when I sit down, that was adaptive. It was a way of regulating attention. So he recognized immediately that he was getting in his old script, and what he needed to do by staying in the present moment, finding ways to stay grounded and focused, he could cleave the past from the present and be totally in that performance flow that he knew how to do for that first book. So he reframed his excitement as validation of being in a new experience, as a signpost of progress. He did this with a little bit of help, as a signpost of progress to continue moving ahead in his writing. In other words, we reframed his interpretation of his correct reading of brain activation of being excitement instead of anxiety. With anxiety, he better head for cover. He better distract himself like he did in the past that helped him not go nuts. In the present, it was keeping him from writing. The result, he produced an even bigger bestseller. We're in discussion mode now. Thoughts or questions or clarifications about anything we talked about? Is this extending, hopefully, the sense that it makes about regulating states of mind, about integrating understanding into practical, useful stuff as coaches? Thoughts or questions about any aspect of that?
This is Magdalena.
I heard the guy first, and I'm going to go with that, and then we'll come back. Go ahead, please. Say your name.
Yeah, this is Kip.
Oh, Kip, hey, how are you doing? Go ahead. If I'd have known it was you, I'd have definitely put you last, but go ahead now that you're talking. Okay.
Well, at last, I get to see everybody else's mistakes first, so okay. Would you be willing to just briefly state the difference between column 3 and column 4 on the neural conditioning chart?
Okay, yeah. Column 3 is the mantra, the cue, the focus, the physiology, like dribbling the basketball twice. Whatever your cue is, mine, remember, was the index finger and the thumb. It just cues that physiology, the deep breath while focusing the thoughts, the focus and the physiology, so that ultimately when you do this enough times, I can simply put my index finger and thumb together and instantly get in that state. So it rewires even the mantra, the cue. And then the fourth column is the ideal behavior. So from a grounded and centered state, you move into ideal behavior. So when you do that across from trigger to ideal behavior, when you do that enough with repetition, it rewires, so it's a neural conditioning. Make sense?
Yeah, so the ideal behavior is the outcome you're looking for. And so do you have somebody do a behavior as a commitment right after the cue, or the behavior just naturally comes out of the grounding and then the cueing?
Neither. The idea about doing this and planning it, mapping it, to do the first two together as an observer and then do the last two as another brainstorming session, so that there's, like with Barbara, my example, so that she had an idea of exactly how she wanted to respond to each of those different triggers already planned out. She didn't have to figure it out on the fly. She didn't have to make, she had already planned. When my dad does this with his eyes, here's how I plan to respond. This is an ideal. So she had already mapped it out. She had that mapped out too, at least generally how she wanted to respond. So it wasn't something she had to figure out, but just by being an observer, she could get grounded and centered more quickly and effectively by doing that mantra and then move into the ideal behavior, ultimately in a seamless way. So
okay.
I hope that's helpful. We'll have more discussion at the end if it's not, Kip. I want to get back to the other comment or question. Would you go ahead, please?
Okay, hi, this is Magdalena.
Okay.
Very tactically, when you were talking about the three questions to formulate at night,
yep,
and then to drive the peak state, and I just want to make sure I understood this correctly. Three questions are formulated at night, and in the morning when you wake up, you think about the answers to those, or are you formulating the answers the night before?
No, it's the idea of responding to the question. You have three questions there. As soon as you turn on your lamp, you grab before your feet, you grab those questions, and you respond to the question. You know, what am I excited about today and going to make a major contribution? What is the greatest opportunity? Whatever questions that you've written out, you're going to respond to those. And responding to them will put you in a state of mind that will determine the rest or the immediate beginning of your day and more likely the rest of the day. To be in an optimal, positive state of mind, ready to take on whatever you're doing. And you may have the same questions or you may have different questions the next day. But I'd say continue it for a week or 10 days and see what it's like. Does that make sense?
Yes, it did, and you had answered my tag-on question with whether they stayed the same or changed. So thank you so much.
You may want to change them. You may see what works, but it's positive. It's not. Remember, the unconscious can't tell the difference between positive or negative. So make it positive, not just the avoidance of something negative. If you say, you know, I want to stay out of debt, guess what happens? Your unconscious listens and says, your wish is my command. So, you know, think about if you're a dry cleaner, you want the person who's putting on that suit to think, you know, the one thing I want to do is not get a stain on this suit. You're in business, so keep it positive and
yep.
Not avoiding something negative, because negative is a focus as well. And
yep.
We know from quantum physics, we get what we focus on.
Got it.
Okay, I know we're
Thank
over
you.
Time. I want to respect the time. If there are questions or comments that you want to send by email, feel free. If there are still some more answers to those questions you want to submit, or if you want to change your mind, let me know, and we'll pick up right here next time you see the outline and what we'll be talking about. Thank you for your participation, energy, and all the comments, including email. I look forward to picking up right here next time. Thanks very, very much. Take good care.
Good night, Jay.
See you.
Good night.
Good night. Thank you so much.